I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit. Do, do, do,
do, do. Can't Lit. Talk about books and stuff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Era Chapman, and this is Can't Lit.
Just kidding. Is my impression better than Jen's? Please go to Can't Lit on Twitter and vote on whose impression is better, Dina's or Jen's.
I mean, I think it's a real toss-up.
I love writing books about stuff.
That was uncanny.
Thank you. I know. I'm really good at impressions. I've studied so much.
I mean,
so I'm really good at them.
We need to teach a class. We need to teach a podcasting class. How to do impressions.
So if anyone wants to pay us to teach a cool workshop for other podcasters on how to do impressions of local literary celebrities, we got you covered. We got you covered. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Dina.
Welcome to our show.
Welcome to Can't Lit.
Welcome to our show. Hello, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. If you are tuning in.
However,
if you're tuning out. Before we start, I just wanted to address something. A friend of the podcast alerted me to something that I just wanted to talk about, mention very briefly, as I did in the previous episode. I very casually said something about brain injuries and people with brain injuries in the previous episode. And it really was, it wasn't a joke. I wasn't making a point. I literally was just very casually throwing words around in a way that was a bit careless. And I just want to say, of course, brain injuries are obviously very serious. And sometimes we just say things not thinking that they might be harmful or rude, and not even thinking that there's any gravity to it at all. And it was a total brief moment in the episode, and you maybe even missed it when you listened, but a very sharp listener did. So again, I just want to say that, sorry, that was unrelated.
That was your Aaron Chapman impression.
Yeah, that
bubbling
was
my
new Aaron Chapman impression where it's all in the throat. Mm. But I just wanted to apologize for any insensitivity in my words, because we all do stuff like that. We make mistakes, we say things that we don't mean to, we try to control our language in a way where we aren't being ableist, but it's so ingrained that sometimes you just throw stuff around casually. And I'm fancy, so I want to maintain that fanciness.
I want to say thank you to people for holding us accountable.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Thank you, friends of Can't Lit.
Thank you, friends of Can't Lit. I didn't ask if I could identify this excellent listener, total friend of the pod.
With very
total
good hair.
Total FOP.
With very good hair, as all of our friends have.
Yeah. So I hope that doesn't give it away. It doesn't. Everyone's beautiful that listens. Everyone's beautiful. But I really do appreciate it. And thank you for listening, and thank you for responding. We like communication, and part of the reason we started the podcast was to create conversations, and so having them outside of these two mics, three mics, however many we have in an episode, enriches the episodes themselves, and also just the conversations that we have around all the different things culturally, socially, that we talk about on the episode. Also, maybe the way I'm addressing this is also bad, so please let me know. Happy to continue to do this.
Hey, hold us accountable.
Yeah, thanks.
I have a story that will lead into our topic for this podcast.
Hashtag can't lit accountable.
Can't. Ooh. No, I don't like it.
It's terrible.
I don't like it at all.
I'm kidding.
I don't like it.
I had to say it, but
I have a story. I was doing some work, editing work, and I made a...
We just were talking about plastic surgery, so when Jen just right now said, I was doing work, I was like, what kind? Continue.
Would you like a chin implant? Jen Suk Fong Lee can do it for you.
She's got a great little studio. Yep. I mean, lab. I mean...
Powder room.
Yeah.
Which is semi-hygienic. I was doing some editing work, and I made like a gender identity mistake, and the person who it was about held me accountable for it, and I felt terrible, and I hated myself, legit hated myself for probably 2 weeks. Couldn't sleep, having nightmares, because that is one of my worst nightmares. And so this leads into our topic for this episode, which is, self-loathing.
I mean, I've definitely, both professionally and just in general, like existing in the world and on the internet, have done similar things where, I've been held accountable and had to really look at myself and what I'm up to and what I'm about and take that in. And it does, it makes you feel bad. Like I for sure have, you know, been lying awake at night or waking up at 3 a.m, which is my favorite time to worry about stuff.
It's cool. It's real cool.
Yeah. It's a very cool time. Actually, it's maybe usually a bit closer to 4 because birds are doing stuff. Birds are doing their bird thing. And maybe they're also just reminding me of my own shittiness. It's hard to say.
You're shitty. Cool, cool.
Yeah. You're a piece of garbage. That's what the birds are saying. And it's kind of offensive.
I mean, they're jerks.
So today we're going to talk about self-loathing and how it relates to writing, creativity. Also, maybe again, like sort of the way we exist, even outside of our own work, mm-hmm. promotion, all of that stuff. Anything kind of related to these really negative feelings that we have about ourselves personally and the way that we think of ourselves, both in terms of our work and again, all this other stuff. Yeah. So Jen, do you want to start with something?
You know, I was actually, this is a little story. I've been writing an essay, which has been really difficult for me to write about, Asian fetish actually specifically. And that led me into this terrible rabbit hole of self-loathing, which is because you having to examine, you know, knowing what Asian fetish is in a kind of overall systemic way is not that hard to understand. What's difficult to understand is how those sort of systemic oppressions work on your intimate life. And having to examine that for me made me feel terrible. Like I hated myself for every relationship choice I've ever made in my life. So my question then for you, Dina, is have you ever started to write something that seemed like a good idea, but then you started to write it and you had to do something or go deeper inside yourself and it just made you hate your life and hate yourself?
Yeah, all the time.
Oh, all the time. Excellent.
I mean, I think sometimes, I think it's different things. Sometimes it's subject matter. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's my own incapability to get something to the place where it needs to be. So like a craft level thing where I'm like, you fucking can't do this. You're so bad at this. You're so shitty. And
you're no David Foster Wallace.
I mean, I would never say that about myself.
Yeah, you really aren't.
Dina Del David Foster Wallace is my new name.
Check Dina's Twitter handle.
I think it's too long. I don't think it'll fit.
We could try.
I'm going to do my best. It'll be Dina Del DFW.
DFW. Yeah.
I mean, also, this is a bit of a sidebar, but if anyone has suggestions for me to change my Twitter name, I'm always open to it. You know I love a fake. You know I love a dull alias.
I'm like, oh, now I'm trying to think of one. Anyway.
But yeah, I think there's like a longer fiction project that I've really wanted to work on. And there have been a few different elements of it. I think both craft-wise, like the fact that it's something novel length. And also just details that kind of blossom into potentially bigger plot points or character things that I found difficult because I was like, oh, am I now doing something appropriative by making this move? So like having to go back and look at that and then that kind of waylaying me into being like, okay, well, what kind of choices can I make instead of this? Or thinking about just like how personal maybe some of that stuff is and being like, okay, well, should I talk to other people in my life, even though this is fiction? Like, how do I want to approach that without being that shitty person that's just like writing about people mm-hmm. willy-nilly with no respect? And because I so rarely do write very pointedly about my own life, it's complicated for me to, whether it's in poetry or fiction or my very terrible attempts, I guess I have a lot of self-loathing about nonfiction, into that area. Because that's something that always feels new to me because I feel like I'm constantly learning about that part of it. Like, how do I address things that involve other people in my sphere?
How do you? I mean, this is one of those...
Without totally ruining them and also ruining yourself by feeling completely awful the whole time.
Yeah, that's a real thing. Like, I mean, when I wrote The End of East, it was so very, you know, clearly based on my family.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of fear in that respect. But I think... there are some topics, of course, that we're not going to write about. And this sort of leads into, you know, what I've been doing lately, writing like essays and stuff. And then I just had an essay come out in The Walrus today. And then, you know, they actually did a whole fact checking thing. And they called one of my sisters and asked her about all the stuff. And then I realized like there are things that I can't, that I will probably never write about because I can't.
The Walrus did more fact checking than Moby's publisher.
Yes.
Anyways, continue.
You know, it's not, we need to slam Moby more in this podcast, obviously. You shirtless wonder you. So they did this whole fact checking thing and I realized that there are things that, you know, this whole self-loathing issue is, there are things that I have written about that haven't seen the light of day because they've just been, you know, too much. There are topics I will never write about people in my family or people in my life. And that's okay. But that's also like, this is where self-loathing, I think, can be kind of useful in the sense that if you like yourself too much, then you're just going to go rogue. What are you going to do? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think there's a difference between complete self-loathing and then complete like over the top self-confidence, sort of being self-critical, sort of, which I think is sort of in the middle where we, you know, the term critical gets used sometimes negatively, but I don't think it is. I think it's something that we do, like being critical and using critical thought isn't just a blanket bad thing. It's something that we do, yeah, in order to both make our work better, to look at things in a way where we're seeing more of the work and who it may affect and what we're actually saying and doing that interrogative work, which just is good writing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think Alicia Elliott said that in the episode where we talked to her last year, because I was, as I always do, I'm like, you're good at nonfiction. Please tell me about why you're good at it.
Tell me your secrets.
Yeah. I just am constantly like on this track, but she said something very similar about, you know, just like doing that work and going deep and really thinking critically and thoughtfully. And I think that's totally true. Okay, I have a question for you.
Okay.
It kind of relates to what we just talked about, but for me, I think about like, what do you think this type of thinking, because it really is rooted in, you know, this thought process that we go through, has to do with us personally versus the work we do versus the expectations of our work in the world. Because I think it functions on these three sort of levels, like the personal. Because for me, so much of this stuff is about me, like thinking about myself and being like internalized self-hatred, mm-hmm. right? But then there's also the other parts of it, like looking at the work itself and being like, oh, I also, this is bad. And then also looking out into the world and being like, are other people also going to think this is bad? Mm-hmm. And so
well,
tag your it, Jen.
Yeah. Like personally, I think the self-loathing, how it manifests for me a lot of the time is that I think I can't write something. Like I think I can't do it. And I think, well, I'm not good enough for that. So one of the things that I always say that I'm not good at, and I don't even actually know if it's true because I've never tried, is I always think I can't experiment with form. Like I write full sentences. I write in clearly delineated paragraphs with like quotation marks. Yeah. I won't even put dialogue in italics. Like, it's like, these are things that I can't do that. I can't do it. So, but who knows? Maybe I could.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Then how are you doing? Are you doing any of that with poetry?
My dialogue in poetry is always italicized.
But like in general, you're kind of exploring things in a slightly different way than you were with a prose line.
I do think though, Dina, you've read some of my poems, is that I do still write in full sentences. Like they're not, I don't think there's any, really, I don't. Like, because I look at other people's work and like I really admire, you know, like Shazia. Yeah. Hafiz Ramji, who was a former guest friend of the podcast, mm-hmm. and her work to me exists on this whole other level where form is fluid and theme and form are fluid together, and they intersect in this way that is so beautiful. And I'm like, well, I can't do that. And my brain is only the size of a walnut.
Yeah.
That's my next Aaron Chapman impression. And so
I thought that was an impression of one of the birds outside my window.
That's a seagull, clearly.
Yeah. I love seagulls, though.
So that kind of thing. That's where I don't do certain things. Like people, like I write multiple genres, but there are lots of things I don't do with them. And then in terms of like my writing, like I get so disappointed sometimes with what's on the page because I intended to do so much more with things, particularly if I'm writing stuff that have a kind of like, say, you know, social justice component. I don't love those words, but like if I say I'm writing something about race or gender or, you know, feminism or whatever, and what exists on the page, I get so disappointed because I feel like the social issues and the politics are so clear in my head and they fall apart when I'm trying to write them. So that's where, like with the writing, I will often, like I had an essay come out in a magazine and I really didn't like it at all. Like it really bothered me and I hope it disappears and no one ever reads it again. And it's just, that happens to me pretty much constantly, especially with prose. It doesn't happen with me with poetry so much, but prose, it definitely does.
Do you think that part too comes from, I don't know, it's weird. It's almost like we have goldfish brain, mm-hmm. even though we know we can revise things, we can make changes, we have the skills and we've done it before. Part of our brains is doing something that's telling us we can't, and that this is it. Like, you know, you write a draft and you're like, well, that's it. That's the end. This is horrible. And it's almost like the process has to just be, part of it is hating it.
And I think that's one of the,
even though, you know, deep down, this is part of a much longer road of writing that you will do.
Yeah. So anything that you write goes through multiple drafts. There's always one draft where you really hate it. Like you just fucking hate it. Doesn't matter what you're writing.
It's the hardest thing.
And that draft changes. It could be early. It could be later. It doesn't matter. But there is always the ugly.
It punches you right in the face. It does. I always do feel like I am being pummeled.
It punches me in the tits. Doesn't punch me in the face. Really works.
It's
hurts.
Never going for the face.
No, not my face.
Not your beautiful face.
Not my beautiful face.
No, this is where the money is.
I think when it comes to like how I'm perceived in the public, I always am terrified that people are going to understand the jig is up, that like eventually everyone will realize I'm not a very good writer at all. And they'll be like, she writes full sentences with proper punctuation. That's no fun. And then it's done. And then I'm done. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that. Like I'm always like, well, you have one trick, Del Bucchia. Like, no one else is going to figure out your business, or everyone's going to figure out your business. Yeah. And this is what you're about.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be interested
like,
again.
Eventually someone's going to be like, there's Jen writing about sad Chinese people again. Screw it.
You know, for perspective, I always, when I'm in these moments, I'm like, well, think about literally people that write the same book every time. And they,
which neither of us have done.
No, but there's lots of very popular writers overall who do that and have done it.
And make a good living.
And yeah, like, so it is fine, but it's to me, it's always coming from this very personal place of my own standards and feelings about myself, as opposed to it coming from an external place. Like I of course worry about external factors, but I always, and maybe this is an extrovert thing, I always think, okay, well, there's a way for me to learn from external stuff, but what can I learn from inside this husk of a human shell filled with meat? Like,
I don't want to learn what's
inside. It's like, you're bad. I don't want to know. You're bad at stuff. You're just bad at it. And that personal learning is so much more difficult, like on an internal
level,
so
hard.
As opposed to having external either validation or criticism or whatever it is. It's so much easier to parse that. And I mean, I don't know. I've never meditated. I don't know what it's like. I heard it's like really hard. I heard it's like really hard. So I just never tried it. I would rather do 50 push-ups.
Oh, I would do 50 push-ups any day. That's fine. I mean, it's going to hurt. And then it'll take me 3 days to do the 50 push-ups. Like,
I think maybe at some point, though, when you're doing 50 push-ups, your brain maybe starts to replicate some kind of meditative state.
Oh,
because you're just like...
Is that a...
I don't know.
Maybe that's a thing.
I'm making this up. Oh, hey, welcome to Making Stuff Up with Gina and Jen. Please do not consider this a self-help podcast. I know all of our listeners know that I am an unlicensed poet therapist.
Yes, you are.
I'm a poetic therapist. Unlicensed and...
UPT for short.
Yeah, no credentials.
Not UTI, but UPT.
If you have a UTI, I hope you're taking care of it. Take good care of your body the best that you can. But also if you don't, it's okay because taking care of your body is hard.
Okay. Here's a question though. So one.
Wait, is it about my number one hit song?
Yes.
Okay, great.
The UPT versus UTI take care of your body / remix by Diplo. He was in the Detective Pikachu movie. I just want everyone to
I'm going
to
go see it on Friday.
It's very enjoyable.
Diplo. Rita Ora's in it.
Rita Ora and Diplo.
I'm pretty excited, to be honest.
Are in it. And Rita Ora, whatever. But Diplo, I saw Diplo on the screen. He's a DJ. He plays himself, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he comes on the screen and I yelled at Oscar, who doesn't care. That's Diplo!
He's like, I'm here for Detective Pikachu, okay?
No, he's like, but that's Charizard. Who cares about...
Oh, he likes Charizard.
No, he likes...
Clefairy.
No, he, I guess his favorite of the ones...
Magikarp.
Well, Mewtwo has a big role. Great. And he likes Mewtwo. And the Greninjas have a big role. He likes the Greninjas.
Okay.
Yeah. And he thought Pikachu was funny.
No, that's good.
Yeah. And he was like, here's the thing. And then I'll stop talking about Detective Pikachu for all you... We're lost listeners right now.
You never know. We might talk about Detective Pikachu every episode from now on.
My child really loves Pokemon. Has loved Pokemon for several years. And I didn't realize how much of it I absorbed. I'm watching the Detective Pikachu movie. Literally any Pokemon came on the screen. I'm like, oh my God, look at the Snorlax. Like I knew exactly who everybody was. And I don't know if I should be proud of this or not, but I also knew all the rules of their world. Like I knew everything.
It's great.
It's a real thing. Anyway, here's my question.
Okay.
Switching gears. Okay. Is that one of my sort of greatest self-loathing things is that I never think of myself as being like an academic thinker or a theoretical thinker.
Same.
Right. So does this like happen to you? Like, do you ever get a question or you read a review about your work that is leaning to the academic and literally your brain freezes and you're like, I don't know. And then does that lead into a spiral of self-loathing for you? Because it does for me.
It doesn't for me only because I think I can acknowledge that those smart people who are writing those types of essays or reviews or doing that critical work, I'm kind of glad that they found something in my work that was worthwhile. And they have the skills to do that. So that actually makes me feel a little bit chuffed, where I'm like,
it does feel very validating. Like, actually,
there are people who are seeing past the fart jokes and they're really getting into the meat and the potatoes and the garnish, all of it, of
a little parsley curl,
little adorable parsley curl. There's some pickled vegetables just hanging on the side. You can still eat them. They're totally good for you. But that isn't a thing that sets me into a spiral. That is a thing where I feel like, oh, someone who is smarter than me in this way is seeing stuff and can wrap their head around things in a way that I can't. And I'm glad. Mm-hmm. For me, it's more like if I were in a conversation with that person or on a panel or something else, that would make me spiral. Like if I was in a position where I had to then account for myself in comparison to that type of dialogue and analysis, that would stress me out.
I think it only really like started to stress me out sort of recently. I'm at the end of East now is, if anyone's wondering what that noise is Rosie trying to pick up her bone? There, she's got it.
Rosie's just dragging a bone along the ground.
She's just going to the carpet now. She's
like
fine.
A grave robber.
Isn't there a grave digger in Hamlet? Mm-hmm. Is that a Hamlet? Yeah. She's being like that guy.
She's that guy.
And
alas, poor York. Rosie has this femur or something.
That's it. Alas, poor York. It's a deer antler. this is what she's doing. Oh, yeah. Mm, they're naturally shed so that they're like ethical. Anyway, right. So it's only happened recently because like now the End of East is how many years old? 12.
12.
12 years old. So now there have been like, you know, graduate theses written about or that mention my books and various sorts of like academic study. And, you know, often the students, the people who write these things will, you know, tag me or like, you know, send it to me or whatever. And it was only like there was one like anthology of like critical Candlelit essays that somebody had put together, like an academic thing. And I read this really smart and incisive essay that was essentially about my work. And I just, it felt really good. But also at the same time, I thought, I almost don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know, like I do, but I don't.
Oh yeah, for yeah. sure. Like there's so much academic language that I don't understand. And yeah, I guess I just like, I'm like, those people are smart and they like it. So cool. Cool beans.
Just like, don't ask me questions about it. Don't ask me questions about it because I won't be able to answer and then I'll feel bad.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's a question as we kind of move toward maybe not concluding this conversation, but definitively, but our time. Over time, has this type of feeling lessened for you? Or is this something that kind of overwhelms certain projects or certain moments or certain types of writing or even like discourse, online interaction, whatever?
I think it's, has it lessened? Yes. In relation to my specific types of writing. Yes. I think in the actual craft of writing or the process of writing, I think I have a lot more confidence about what I'm able to do now than I did. And that's partly because I've been pushing myself to write new genres in the last few years.
Yeah.
It's good. And it's good for me. It's good for me to keep my brain moving. But where it's shifted is into sort of online interactions and stuff. Like I'm sometimes really, it's not that I don't like what I say or I don't like what my persona is, but I feel sometimes that I've created a persona that feels burdensome sometimes, and that is my own fault. And then again, you hate that. Like I hate that. I don't know. What about you?
You are allowed to also not feed into that persona. And I think that's something we forget too, that, you know, it doesn't mean that we don't maintain a level of integrity or whatever it is. It just means like, you know, I think this is why people like your online presence, because you'll share other people's work. You'll support other people. You will talk about your own work. You will, talk about bigger issues that are affecting you, and you'll speak very candidly and I think smartly about that. But then also you'll just like, tell us about Rosie and like what she's up to. So it's not as if it's just solely this like one thread of your being. And so to me, it's those types of interactions or, you know, not necessarily, I never really take long online breaks, but to kind of move away and be like, listen, here's some stuff I think is important. Also, yesterday, I just tweeted that I'd never seen the movie Scream.
You really haven't, eh?
No.
Oh.
I'm not really a horror movie person.
Okay.
And at that time, I wasn't, I don't know. When you live in a town where there's like one theater, what do you do, right?
It's okay. You don't have to see it.
Yeah. I don't care that I haven't seen it. Like, I don't feel bad at all.
I've never seen Avatar.
I haven't seen Avatar. Are you kidding me? Of course I haven't seen Avatar.
I've never seen Game of Thrones.
I mean, I have seen Game of Thrones.
Okay.
TV for me is easier. I will watch TV more readily than I'll watch movies.
I mean, I've never read any David Foster Wallace.
I've only read a few essays. I've read some essays.
There was a tennis. There's one about Roger Federer.
Yeah, there's a tennis. Yeah. He really loved tennis.
Yeah.
There's tons of stuff, though. That's the other thing. Like, I think when I was younger, I had a lot of self-loathing about my reading habits and things that I wasn't doing that I was supposed to be doing. And now I don't feel any of that. So in that way, I think in the way that, like, the expectations of me as a literary person or whatever, that stuff has for sure lessened. And I think that impacts the other stuff too, like my work, who I am. It makes you kind of realize that you obviously have flaws. Everybody does. And to be able to move through that, like this is kind of, you know, me thinking, and you can answer this too, like finding ways to cope or move through the self-loathing. And I think part of that for me is that exact thing of being like, oh, well, not everyone else has experienced, you know, these pieces of art or whatever it is. And they struggle with their own writing. And you're like, oh, well, that's me too. Like, I'm doing this same thing, but I don't have to feel bad about everything that I haven't read or seen or...
Well, this is the thing about community too, though, right?
Every person, like everyone's traveled in Europe except me, and I don't feel bad.
I feel like community plays
or wherever,
big
travel
big
in general, don't feel bad about it.
So when I was like a younger writer, this is like a shorter story, is that I certainly felt a lot, I would have panic attacks before I went to literary events because I really didn't like the idea of feeling less than or that I didn't belong.
Yeah.
And that of course has lessened because as my career grows and you know, you write more books, people know who you are, your profile grows. But I think that that confidence going into an event is one of the greatest gifts that has happened to me in the last, you know, 15 years. Yeah. And I will say that I know, I see this online that people still feel that CanLit is cliquey and that even like the new, what people would call the new CanLit, I say with air quotes, is also cliquey. And by when people say that, I'm like, are you subtweeting me? Because of course that's where my ego is. But it's, if you do feel like you're not a part of that community, I do think that that is something that for sure will lessen as the years go on. But I do will say like a word of reassurance to that is that if you ever see me at one of these events, please do talk to me. I'll talk to you. I'll
bring you a snack. If I'm at an event, you know, and people do slide into my DMs to ask me questions and talk to me. And I have a website. I don't have a website with my email address there for no reason. Like, sure. Sometimes a weird guy that lives in Comox, asks if you want to come live on his farm and shares a bunch of photos of some animals that he's
that
killed.
Happened?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah, okay.
And you're just like, okay, well, I'm never responding to this, but the website works. People are in communication. Cool. So I made up Comox. I don't remember where it was. But yeah, I think that's part of it. And even when I was younger, when I've had less confidence overall, approaching people was hard. And I think part of that was too, though, there were more people that were closed off. And I think, as you'd said, nothing is fixed, nothing is perfect, but more people are open to talking to emerging writers and people outside of their, because of course there are groups, there are friend groups, like this is our workplace.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have an office and stand around a water cooler because we don't have that. That's online and that's our events and that's our hangout time and whatever it is that we do. Like we can't leave after work and go to happy hour because we don't all work in the same place. Some people work at home, some people have other jobs. And so the way we interact is so bizarre.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a shared space the way that other types of workplaces do. So, yeah, I'm always open to talking to people. And of course, I'm so naive. I just want to support everyone and it's terrible. I'm like, I just want to support everyone and I want everyone to... I'm that jerk at the end of in Mean Girls who's just like talking about rainbows and puppies and kittens before they are like having their long conversation about all the people that have hurt them or whatever and blah, blah, blah. I'm taking the crown and I'm breaking it into pieces and throwing them around.
I mean, Dina really is like that, people.
That it's not perfect.
No, and none of us can. No.
But at the same time, to be fair, there are people that I have a strong vendetta against. So listen, don't think that's not also true.
Yeah.
I'm also very hateful.
If you're one of those people, don't talk to Dina.
Or if you do, be prepared.
You know what? Dina and I at this point have taken on each other's nemeses. So
it's true. It's good to have a tag team approach. We're like a WWE team.
Pass the baton.
Yeah.
It's someone else's turn pour some haterade into this cage match.
Yeah. I'm gonna roll over the ropes in the tightest spandex you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna tease my hair because that's the kind of wrestling hair I respect.
Same.
Well, I feel like we should end on that note.
Okay.
Power, big power hair and huge bangs.
Yay!
I never had them, was jealous of them.
Oh, no. My bangs were too greasy.
Mine were too thick.
They were like stuck to my forehead. Oh.
I just had like such a dorky child's haircut that they were too thick. And then I'd be like, I don't know how to back comb. I don't know I think once I tried to use a whole can of hairspray and still nothing happened.
Oh.
And then I was like, that's it. I gave up. My self-loathing was too high. Okay. Thanks for listening. Jen, thanks for talking.
Thank you, Dina.
I don't loathe you. I love you.
I love you.
Okay. Bye.